Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today, we'll be talking with Patricia McCarthy, the author of Life in the Country House in Georgian Ireland. Patricia, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark.
I was wondering if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Well, I was kind of late coming to all of this, Mark, to be honest. Some years ago, when my children were just that little bit older and were at school, I decided I'd do a two-year diploma course in the history of European painting, which was something in which I was greatly interested. In the course of doing that, we had study trips to Rome and to Florence, which were just absolutely wonderful, seeing all the pictures that we had studied and even seeing some architecture. Then I decided to kind of take it further and do a Bachelor of Arts degree in Trinity College, Dublin, in the Department of Art and Architectural History. Now, this was interesting because architectural history was part of the curriculum, so you had to do it. In the course of the 4 years then that I was there, I actually discovered that it was architecture that I really wanted to major in, probably because of the really brilliant teacher that I had there. But then again, you know, looking around Dublin and going through this course with him, talking about Dublin as a Georgian city with loads of 18th century public buildings and squares and terraces of Georgian houses, as well as a great number of country houses built in the 18th century. All of that to me was really, really compelling. So after getting that primary degree, and in the meantime, I had written a book on the building of the King's Inns in Dublin, the King's Inns being Ireland's oldest legal institution and also oldest school of law. I decided that I really enjoyed research so much that I just go on and do a PhD, a doctorate. And I had no particular plan with regard to, do I want to teach in a university? Do I want to teach at all? There was nothing like that. It was just, I felt, I'm just going to see how far I can go with all of this. So my supervisor for the PhD was the teacher that I mentioned earlier. And it was he who suggested investigating how rooms got their names and what people did in different rooms in houses in the 18th century. So I was sort of between two minds about that. I wasn't quite sure whether it really appealed to me. But I thought, well, look, I'll have a go. I'll do a bit of research, see what I come up with. And so I embarked on the PhD on that very subject, and I got a huge amount of help from lots and lots of people, terrific encouragement, particularly from the Knight of Glynn, who himself was the owner of a beautiful castle in Limerick, and who kept on saying to me, you know, get the thesis done, Patricia, and then get down and do the book. And I really, when I was doing the thesis, I wasn't thinking in terms of a book at all, but that's what it was, and that's what the book is about. It's a version of the PhD. Happily, I must say, rapidly, because the very idea of reading a PhD is just horrific. Because with a PhD, as you know, you throw in, it's like show off time, and you throw in everything that you know about it. So I just went through the whole PhD, put it into language, which was more accessible, and expressions that were more accessible to an average reader, bearing in mind that I was writing architectural history as well, and so that people from academic backgrounds would be reading it. But anyway, that's what the book is. It's a result of that. And when I finished it, I sort of said to my supervisor, okay, so what are we going to do now? So he said, right, we're going to send it to Yale. But you must be joking. And he said, no, not at all. He said, we'll send it to Yale. He said, I think it should be quite good for them. So we sent it to Yale, and then I was ages and ages waiting. And eventually they came back to me and said, yes, we'd like to go ahead and we'd like to publish your book. So that's how it all came about. All just chance and just wonderful stuff.
One of the things I should mention that really distinguishes this book from the typical dissertation, in addition to the fact, you know, that it's very clearly written, is also the fact that it's gorgeously illustrated. You have quite a phenomenal selection of pictures and sketches and plans, which really do a good job of bringing quite a lot of the details that you described to light.
I think so, and I really do thank Yale very much for that, because as you can imagine, you know, when you're using material like architectural plans, which are over 200 years old, the print on them, and I needed annotated plans, so I needed to see where is the saloon, where is the kitchen, where is the dining room. And on some of them, it was actually quite hard to see. And I was worried when I sent them to Yale, because the very fact is the book is all about the spaces. So when you're using a lot of architectural imagery, you need people to be able to see what I'm talking about at the same time. But they really brought up those pictures extremely well, so that with most of them, even with a couple of them, you might have to get a magnifying glass. But for the most part, you can actually read the architectural drawings. So I'm very grateful for that. Also, they did a super job in the design of the book. I was so pleased with that. It's what a lot of people have mentioned about it. And also the color reproductions. The pictures are really good. But then, you know, we really do have some really nice country houses here in Ireland, which have wonderful interiors.
You were talking about how much of the book is about spaces, and and we'll be discussing that in greater detail in a little bit. But I was wondering if you could start us off by talking about the country houses themselves and what they were like prior to the 18th century. I mean, what makes the country house in the 18th century so distinctly different from what came before?
Well, the funny thing about it is the country houses in Ireland are quite different from... The country houses in Ireland really started with Palladian style houses. In England, there was a whole era before that, because, of course, they had a lot of they had a quieter time than we had in Ireland. We had a lot of wars in the 17th century. But in England, they had a Baroque style of architecture, which was a sort of an encrusted type of building with fancy chimneys and roof lines. Wonderful, wonderful buildings like Blenheim Palace, for example. But we didn't have that. I mean, up to the beginning, up to about 1719, we had castles in Ireland. So we didn't have an architecture other than castles. So those castles were divided really between what we call tower houses, which would be high castles, and semi-fortified houses, which would be like 3 or 4 story houses, quite wide. But the semi-fortified, they were classical in style with regular features, but they had defensive galleries and they had loopholes on them for defense, and they were surrounded by a fortified outer wall, like Portumna Castle in County Galway. That's an example. And that house fared very badly in the 17th century wars in Ireland. The other ones, the castles, which were tower houses, were when people built a house attached to the tower house. It would probably be lower than the tower house, but it could be around about the same size. So it meant that it was like hedging your bets. If there was going to be an attack, you could leave your more modern house, which is right attached to your castle, and then hop into the castle until the danger was past.
So in the 18th century, the country house doesn't so much evolve the way it does in England, as much as it does undergo almost an evolutionary leap.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, Palladianism was really the first style of architecture that we had, from the beginning of the 18th century, from about 1897. Sorry, I keep on saying 18 for the 18th century, but it's 17. About 1719, when Castletown House was started. And Palladian, I don't know whether you want me just to say a little bit about Palladianism, Mark?
Please do. What exactly is Palladianism, and from where did it come?
Sure, yeah. Well, Palladianism is a style of architecture which came from the 16th century Italian architect called Andrea Palladio. And what his architecture was really governed by the principles of classical antiquity. And that would be as known from surviving buildings and from the writings of the first century BC theorist, Vitruvius. So he was kind of the first architect. He looked around, he saw the sort of buildings, and he talked about the buildings, and he talked about symmetry and proportion. And so this was taken up in the 16th century by Andrea Palladio, who built a lot of houses near Venice, villas for people who are living in Venice and wanted to relax and get out of Venice during the summer when the canals and the water can be quite smelly, and they wanted to go and relax in the countryside. So he built a style of houses at that stage, architecture which was noted really for its clarity, its order, symmetry, proportion, all of those, but much plainer than we would think when you think in terms of the Baroque, an awful lot plainer than that and very regular. So that dominated house building in Ireland from the beginning of the 18th century. And Palladianism was introduced to England, first of all, by Lord Burlington, who then built his own house called Chiswick House in London, which is very much in the style of a Palladian house. Sir Edward Lovett Pierce, then, who was an Irish architect, he did his grand tour. He went to Italy and to France and studied Palladio's works. And then he came back to Ireland and brought it with him. So Irish Palladianism really was a toned-down version of English practice. For example, we didn't have in Irish Palladianism, one of the things that they have in Palladianism, certainly in the Veneto and also in England, were porticos. You have them also in the United States, in the White House and all of that. So porticos were found to be too expensive for Irish people. So we don't have quite the same as the wonderful huge houses, huge Palladian houses that they have in England. We have a toned down version, a slightly smaller version of these of this English practice. But we do have details such as tripartite doorways with a pediment over them, Venetian windows and semicircular Diocletian windows. But Edward Lovett Pierce and his successor, who was called Richard Castle, really favoured Palladio's plan of a central block. So the house was a central block, joined then by straight or curved arcades or colonnades, which sort of came around from the main block of the house, curved around and ended or terminated in pavilions, such as those at Mount Vernon in Virginia. So the style really suited and was really taken to heart by the Irish nobility and gentry. And it lasted even into the beginning of the 19th century. But it wasn't confined to big houses. When I say big houses, well, it's all relative when you think in terms of British houses. But it wasn't confined to big Irish houses. Screen walls could be substituted in smaller houses for the arcades, because arcades or colonnades would be very expensive to build. Houses like Castletown here in County Kildare and Rusborough in County Wicklow would both have these. But, you know, if somebody else was building, hadn't the money to do so, they just have screen walls coming from the main block of the house down to the pavilions. And that looked absolutely fine. You could decorate your wall. But an important difference in Irish practice was something that is quite interesting. The pavilions were used, or one of the pavilions was used as stables. Now, that was the whole idea where Palladio was concerned. In the Veneto and in the villas that he designed, one of the pavilions was always used as stables. Now, when that style translated itself to England, they didn't use them as stables, or certainly not often. They used them for extra accommodation. So you might have a library in an English pavilion, or you might have a billiard room or something like that. But in Ireland, they were never. The one pavilion was always used as a stable building, and the other pavilion would be used for the kitchen and services.
So they were not trying to simply unimaginatively import the design. They were adapting it to the needs of the
Irish clientele.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you have to bear in mind too the love that Irish people had for their horses. The very fact that your horses are accommodated almost in the house was sheer bliss for the Irish landowner, because they enjoyed horses, they raced their horses, they spent a lot of time on their horses, on their equipage and everything like that, but horses were hugely important. The other thing about it was that it was awfully convenient for people to have their stable in the pavilion attached to the house, because the master of the house, when you think of it, the only way of mode of transport really was horse. When he could just simply walk out of his study, which was generally on the ground floor of the house, and he could either just simply go straight into the arcade or colonnade or whatever, or just simply walk out and then into his stable, which was right beside him. So the horses in those stables would be the horses in general use. So they would be his horse for riding out, and they would be family horses for riding out. They would also be the coach horses. But any other horses, like race horses, might have a separate stable building to themselves, or they might be in a stables, you know, at a distance from the house. And then the horses used for farm work and everything like that were in another area. They would be in the farm yard, in one of the buildings in the farm yard.
So the horses that were kept close were the horses that were for personal use and the use of the household.
Absolutely.
And the work horses and the show horses, so to speak, for the grounds for racing, those were much further away.
They weren't necessarily on the estate owned by, you know, the owner's estate. He may have them in a stables in somebody else's estate. I don't mean another landowner's estate, but somebody who actually looks after horses all the time.
Another adaptation that you mentioned in the book that I thought was fascinating was how the Italian villas that Palladio designed, or were designed along, you know, in imitation of Palladio's ideas, had shading for the windows, and how in Ireland the very different environmental conditions really made that they really had to go a different route.
Yeah, these were like the porticos and shelters.
Mm-hmm. And how the porticos didn't quite work as well for the Irish design.
Well, they really didn't. But the what was more important really was the fact that they were expensive to have, so it needed an awful lot more work. They weren't favoured, and it's hard to work out quite why. But my theory really was the fact that the advantages for them in the Veneto was that it would keep the sun out. It would give a certain amount of shade to the rooms, and the people could sit in the portico and enjoy that without getting burned from the sun.
It reflected the fact that these were built in an Adriatic climate.
Absolutely.
And
totally different
temperatures,
climate.
Which are, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And then you can have water dripping down from portico onto the steps of the house. And that created slippery steps for any of your guests who are arriving, say for a party or something like that, or for anything, if people were coming in actually the front door. So it wasn't something that particularly attracted Irish clients. You will find some houses certainly do have them, but for the most part, and the major houses like Castletown and like Rusper, they don't have them at all. Yet they have long flights of stairs, or steps rather, up to the hall door. So you really were going to get fairly drowned as you arrived for a party.
You have referred a few times now to Castletown, and in your book you indicate that it really was a seminal construction. And I was wondering if you could explain a bit about how that house in particular came to exert influence over designs of country houses in Ireland in the 18th century.
Well, because it was built by a man called William Connolly, and he was the Speaker of the Irish House of Commons. And so he was a very powerful man. He was also a man who owned a huge amount of land throughout Ireland, not only in County Kildare, where Castletown is located, but all over the place. And so he decided in the early 1720s that he wanted to build a house. And it was said he wanted to build a house using Irish workers and Irish materials. And even the interior, his idea was that he wanted all of the interiors to be like Irish made. So because he was a very important person in Ireland, people were writing letters about, did you hear about Speaker Connolly's house, how big it's going to be, and it's going to be Irish materials, and it's going to be a model for houses in Ireland. And of course, that's what happened. The house itself was apparently, and we're not terribly sure about this, was designed by a man called Alessandro Galilei. And but there's nothing to prove that, but it is generally accepted that he designed it. But Edward Lovett Pierce, this young architect who died certainly before his time, but he was the one who was just back from Italy from all his travels, and he was the one who designed the colonnades and the pavilions, and also, it is said, the wonderful, wonderful hall that is in Castletown. So Castletown was a very big house. It took a long time to build. And we don't know, you know, there aren't any records, building records or anything like that, which is such a shame. But it took a long time to build, but everybody was waiting to see what was going to be the end result. And finally, of course, it was built. And it was from there. And because Connolly was doing this, it made people more architecturally aware. And so a lot of them were waiting and ready to build as soon as his house was complete. And they wanted to see and then copy these new ideas that he had. So it was the Palladian plan, and that was the first of the Palladian houses in Ireland. It is also the biggest of the Palladian houses. But it was very, very plain. It took a long time to be finished. It wasn't really until Lady Louisa Connolly and her husband, Tom Connolly, who was I think he was a grand nephew of Speaker Connolly, he eventually inherited the house and moved in with his wife, Lady Louisa Connolly, who was the daughter to the Duke of Richmond in England. But again, he was a very, very wealthy man, and so she came from a very wealthy family. So between the two of them, they really finished off Castletown House in great splendor. So it was a really, really, really beautiful house. But that was the start. That was the start of Palladianism in Ireland.
We've been talking a little bit about parts of the house, and what I'd like to do now is to talk in more detail about the designs and layout. And this is something that forms the structure of much of your book, is you take us through the various portions of it in some detail. You've described, for example, how one of the concerns they had in Ireland was entering the house, and how you had to deal with the fact that because of the water, that oftentimes the steps were slippery. I was wondering if you could speak a bit more about the approaches. I mean, what was it, you know, how did they lay out not just the house, but the grounds leading up to the house, the way that people, saw the house for the first time?
Well, you know, I remember when I started studying the country house in the first place, I remember somebody saying to me, you'll always know the beginnings of a country house from the road, not the driveway, from the road outside, because you'll know it by the sort of clusters of vegetation and lots of lovely trees and bushes and everything like that. And of course, the high stone walls, which were built around them. So the whole thing was almost like a theatrical experience, because first of all, as I say, you'd come to the wall, the high wall around it, probably around about 9 or 10 feet high, right around. Then you'd come to the entrance gateway, which could be in the form of a triumphal arch. It would always have a lodge, a gate lodge, for people to open the gate and then shut it after you. And they, the houses that were, the little houses that were lodges, were lived in by people who looked after the gate. And they were, the extraordinary thing was that, you know, sometimes later on, and I know I'm jumping on a little bit here, but sometimes later on people built castle-style houses. But they never, ever at any stage minded whether the lodge at the gate was also a castle-style house or a little baby castle sitting at the gate. Or in the case of the Palladian houses, they didn't attempt to create anything that was particularly Palladian at the gate. The lodge was just a building, and it's whatever they decided to put there. They weren't worried about, does it match the architecture of the house? However, there were all sorts of different types of lodges, even to the extent of putting a lodge sometimes across the road from the entrance to the house. And this was a kind of show-off thing to show, well, you know, we own this field too. It's not just what's what is surrounded by the great big stone walls. So that was showing off. And I suppose you could really say, Mark, that these houses were to show off how up to date you were in architecture, to show off how your gardens had been improved, and what you had done with the gardens. And so the drive in your carriage from gateway to house was sometimes quite circuitous, in that you might have this sort of serpentinian route from the gate to the house. But en route, you would see on your left, there might be a lake, a beautiful lake. On your right then, behind some shrubbery or trees, you'll get a little peek of a temple. They would have perhaps a bridge, a quaint little cottage, a mock ruin, all of that. So all the time you're getting this experience of different things until you get to the house. And you are surprised then by the house because you suddenly come upon it. That is quite different to what happened in the earlier part of the century, when houses had straight avenues. So you'd come out the hall door of the house and you could see way, way, way down in front of you. You could see the gateway in. It was decided in the 18th century that it was much more attractive to have this driveway in, where various events were observed as you drove in, and suddenly, oh, here's the house, and wow, isn't it fantastic, and it's so big, and it's so beautiful. And that was it. So it was all designed to impress. The another thing about that was many of the houses were freestanding houses, and I'm talking about now not about necessarily Palladian houses. I'm talking about houses which, of course, were also being built at the same time, not Palladian, but very regular. It had Palladian features in that it was all very, very regular, very proportion, symmetry, order, clarity, and all the rest of it. But they could be square blocks sitting on the top of, you know, a slight incline. And with these houses, like Lisadell, like Bellamont, no sign of a servant, no sign of servants' quarters, no sign of a wing for servants or anything like that. The house sat like a piece of sculpture on the top of this little hill, and no sign of anything. But then they had underground tunnels. And so that was a whole other way of keeping eyesores, like servants, out of the way. And all of the work that was going on in the estate was all done at a distance from the house, behind yet more clusters of trees, where the farmyard and all of the workings of the country house were contained. But these houses were just simply standing on their own. Very, very beautiful, but it was another style. However, just to go back to the Palladian house, so you arrive at the door, then you get out of your carriage. One thing that sort of struck me was, what happens if it really is teeming rain or snow and you're looking out and you're saying, oh my God, my guests are going to arrive and they have to walk up there, their hairstyles will be ruined, their clothes will be dragging in the wet and everything like that. So I actually believe that there was certainly a back door that in a case like that, a person, now it would be the last resort because you really don't want your guests, when you've sort of set yourself up for some sort of a party or anything like that, you don't want them coming in the back way. But in a case of necessity, very possibly they did go in the back way. But, you know, the having a porch or having a portico, from that point of view, you know, there were advantages to that too, because at least you could kind of settle yourself at the top of the steps and brush off the rain or the snow or whatever it was and gather yourself together before being admitted into the house. But we didn't have that. So obviously use of umbrellas, and umbrellas were around at that time. So they just simply had to cope with it and carry on. And I suppose everybody else was doing it, so everybody else was in the same boat.
You mentioned the introduction of entry halls, or the role of entry halls as helping to go some way towards addressing that problem as well.
Yes, that's right. You could. I mean, you could. There were small, what would you say, like almost like ante rooms, but they wouldn't quite be ante rooms. You'd come in and you could certainly sort yourself out there. And you would have the aid of servants and all the rest of it. But then eventually, I mean, you did have to just simply go into the hall and hold your head up and pretend your dress is just lovely, dripping in the wet and mud and everything else.
Well, I'd like to think in that sense, you'd probably be in the same boat as the rest of the guests who were there too.
Absolutely. They're all in the same boat, so it's not too bad. Yeah.
One of the really unique parts of Irish country houses that you describe in your book is the bedroom lobby. And I was wondering if you could speak a bit about what these bedroom lobbies were and what distinguished them from, say, just normal hallways in country houses elsewhere.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was something that I sort of wasn't expecting to encounter. And then somebody, I think it was my supervisor, said to me, you know, what about those spaces outside bedrooms on the first floor that have a light overhead? Why are they so big? What do people do in them? See if you can find out. Well, I never actually did find out what they were, but they're spaces, they're not quite a landing, but they're very like a landing. I don't know if that's what you call that in America, but you know, you get up to the first floor and you arrive in a place where you see all the doors of perhaps the bedrooms or other rooms round about. But this space is, when you get up to there, you might go through a couple of columns and you're into a space. And right enough, you can see all of the doorways around you into different rooms, bedrooms or whatever, dressing rooms, etc. But when you look up, there might be another floor on top of you, but there's like a hole in that floor. And so the people on that floor, they can look down into this lobby, this bedroom lobby. But right up at the very top in the roof is a glass dome. So that throws light right down onto that area where the bedroom lobby is, but also gives light to the story above. Now, in a house like Castle Cool, they have an absolutely huge bedroom lobby. And you wonder, why is this space here? It's so big. What did they do with it? There must have been some purpose. Well, to be honest, I really never got to the very bottom of that. You could decorate it. You could put heaters into it. And you're not sure if that's to heat that particular floor or if it's to have heat go up to the higher bedroom floor as well. But I never came across, in all that I read, anything except for one, which was the lying in state of Lord Coluny, who was the heir to the Earl of Bellamont. And in Bellamont, in the house, which is one of those houses I mentioned earlier, which just stands on its own, his son was laid out there. But they called it, when I read a contemporaneous description of the laying out of his heir, a young man, and they called it the saloon. So that's the only time I came across it. It was an ideal place for him to be laid out, I suppose, really, because there was light shining in from the top and people could simply walk around. However, his body was laid out or in the coffin or whatever. But it's a space that occurs only in Irish houses. And, you know, I did my very best to try and come to some reason why it might be there, and I was never able to do that. Visitors who went to houses, there was one visitor who went to, I think, Castlecool, and he said, yes, it's a peculiar room, something, words to that extent, but he said, it's so noisy because you can hear the servants go to and fro in the morning, early morning, and that's really all. So nothing, but it is extraordinary, and it's in the loveliest of houses. I mean, there's one house which is used by the Italian embassy here, Lucan House, and it has that wonderful, and that was designed by James Wyatt, and the English architect, and it has one of those lobbies as well. Very, very architecturally articulated. So you'd have columns and pilasters and quite a bit of architectural decoration in the space, so that you didn't actually need furniture in it at all. It was quite a unique space in itself.
One of the pictures that is in the book of the space, though, does have chairs in it, and this points to something that we sometimes don't recognize when we go and visit these as exhibits or museums, which is that oftentimes these spaces were inhabited sometimes overnight by the servants themselves. They would be out there waiting or resting, yeah. And to be on call, in essence.
Absolutely. And particularly in townhouses, you find that. Mm-hmm. And also because halls, it was for defense in some cases. Because you would find in the halls would be decorated sometimes with arms. Now, they might be arms used for hunting, shooting, and fishing and that sort of thing. But there were always guns and there were always arms in the vicinity of the hall, so that if somebody was breaking in, first of all, you had a servant sleeping there, usually on the floor. The servant would sleep there and he would be able to alert the members of the family and the rest of the staff that something untoward was happening. But there were also implements in the space, in the hall itself, to try and deal with something like that. But for the most part, the hall was used. It was a multi-purpose room, in fact, the hall was. And there's this wonderful woman called Mrs. Mary Delaney, who is, she was a visitor to Ireland, married to quite an old man. I don't think it was a very happy marriage, but it didn't last very long. This was when she was living in England. She's from a noble family, but she met, while she was over here, the Dean of Down, Down being a county in the north of Ireland. And she met Dean Delaney, and married him much later and came to live in Ireland. But she was a fantastic letter writer. And so huge chunks of information about the 18th century emanate from Mary Delaney's letters, which were all published to her sister and to various people, which give a huge amount of social detail, which I'm sure, Mark, you've read the book, and I'm sure you would see it. Mrs. Delaney pops up everywhere.
Yes, and she does.
Yeah, so she is just absolutely fantastic. But I was going to say something else there now, which has just gone out of my head. She was, what the heck was I going to say? Sorry, what was the question you asked me?
I was talking a bit about the servants and how they were outside the rooms, and you started talking about the, not just...
That's right.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Sorry about that. She would describe house parties when she'd go and visit friends, and they'd have their house parties in the party generally would be in the hall, because usually it was a large space. And usually there wasn't a huge amount of furniture in it. And if there was, it could all be moved out and it could be put into other rooms while people danced, played games, they had musicians in, they would have sing-songs, they did everything. And then to eat, they would go to other rooms in the house and eat and then come back in to dance more. So she was a great person for talking about what people did in halls. She said also, in her own hall in her house in Delville, which is just outside Dublin, it's not there anymore, but she used to have a harper, somebody playing a harp or somebody playing the fiddle, the violin for her while she worked. She just enjoyed the sound of music while she was working away. And she worked away on things like flowers. Shell work. She did a lot of shell work, and she decorated her house with shell work, as one might do for a ceiling, like plaster work in the ceiling. Beautifully done. She also did flowers. She made flowers from coloured pieces of paper, which are extremely beautiful. I think they're in somewhere like the Victorian Albert Museum. They are so beautiful. So she was a multi-talented woman as well as a great letter writer. But she was... Another thing about Mrs. Delaney was, which has always fascinated me, was she would walk into... She would write to somebody about somebody's room. And she'd say, it measures 20 feet by 24. And there was never, like you or I might say, I think it was probably around 20 feet by 24. But she would always give, it was that much. And after a while, I began to wonder, how in the name of God did she know it was that size? And what did she do? And I brought this up. I was giving a talk recently. And I said, how did she do it? You know. And somebody said to me afterwards, by the way, I just wanted to let you know, she brought a measuring tape around with her. So this guy who told me just, you know, he went off, and so somebody else was asking me something, and I didn't get back to him to say, have you got, documented evidence of that?
Yes.
So I don't really know. But even if she did have a measuring tape, wouldn't it be extremely odd for somebody to take out their measuring tape and start measuring your sitting room?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I really don't know how she did it, unless it was something that people said, like, I want you to see my sitting room, my drawing room. And my drawing room measures, it's actually 20 by 24 feet. I suppose, you know, they didn't have magazines. There was no way of disseminating information about houses, except through description from one person to another. You know, you didn't have photography, and people desperately wanted to get news of any new improvements or their new house or anything like that they had made. They wanted to get that across. So I really, again, that's another mystery I haven't solved. I don't know whether she was just fairly sure of herself or whether somebody said to her, this is 20 by 24. Or did she actually, you know, measure it with her feet or whatever. But she was very, very definite about giving... giving descriptions and giving actual measurements of halls, and not only of halls, of other buildings as well, other parts of the building rather. And then the hall was also used in 1770. The Lord Ely entertained his tenants at Christmas time in the hall, and the hall was usually painted in what they call a buff colour, a sort of a beigey colour. First of all, it was a cheap paint, but also because the hall was used all the time, and so it would have to be painted more frequently over a period of time. So this kind of buff colour was quite suitable for a hall. But anyway, Lord Ely entertained his tenants at Christmas time. There were 120 of them. He was a very sort of a flash guy. He liked spending a lot of money. And it was very nice that he entertained his 120 tenants. And altogether they drank 19 gallons of rum, 6 gallons of whiskey, and 2 barrels of ale.
Must have been some party.
A great party.
Yeah.
And then there, in Barber Villa, I mean, this is just some odd pieces about halls. In Barber Villa then, there was a trap door in the floor. So when people wanted wine or something like that, this trapdoor just opened and up he came, the waiter or the footman or whatever came with more wine from the cellar downstairs. So
you mentioned that was a novelty because the correspondent remarked upon it. It was not the kind of thing you typically saw in these houses.
No. I mean, somebody said, oh, my God, would you look at that? You nearly die with fright. So, yes, so the guests were definitely surprised with that. But that I do remember reading somebody who was talking about 18th century houses and said, you know, that that was not completely unusual. But there were, I only came across two mentions of the trapdoor in the floor. Great fun. And then the other thing, I don't know if you want me to just keep on going on about this, but the hall was a place where people waited. And there was an English architect who wrote a book. His name was Isaac Ware. And he wrote a book in the 18th century about houses and how they can be organized and all of that. And he said, you don't have to bother very much about halls, certainly not halls in townhouses, because they're just for the servants. And so I thought, okay, well, it's not really for the servants in the country house. He meant, I think, that people came with their sedan chairs, this would be in the city, and to the townhouse, and they would park their sedan chairs in the hall, and the servants would look after them. So there would be a lot of sedan chairs in the halls and a lot of servants. So that's why it didn't matter there. In the country, it would be it would really be a bit different because there would have to be servants in the hall, because if anybody came to the door, the servant has to be there to open the door immediately. But people came to the house on business in the country house. And they might have come distances, and they would come to talk business. It might be a state business. It might be the local town, which would be owned by the owner of the house. It could be any sort of thing. It could be hairdressers. It could be people selling clothes to them or fitting them for clothes. And they'd have to wait in the hall. And the furniture in the hall was, like the chairs in the hall were hard, wooden chairs, uncomfortable, really. But there was a purpose in the fact that they were uncomfortable, and that was because if you had people coming to, like people like that, tradespeople, as they would call them, first of all, there was a pecking order as to where they would be asked to wait. If they were important tradespeople, they might be put into an anteroom or into the library to wait. If they were just ordinary tradespeople, they'd be left on the uncomfortable chairs in the hall. And there was a lovely story about Richard Brinsley Sheridan, who was a dramatist and a dramatist and also the manager of theatres in London. And in his London house, he had all of these people. He owed money to everybody, and they had all arrived looking for money. And and they were in different parts of the house. So when they heard the door upstairs closing or opening and closing, and he came out, they all, of course, came into the hall and assembled there. And then the person who was writing about this said, everybody stood up when he came down, and he came down the stairs looking utterly, utterly dapper, handsome, gorgeous, full of himself and everything like that. And he just said, good morning, gentlemen, and kind of left her that, still continued all the way downstairs and out the hall door. And they all stood just looking after him. They were so taken with his appearance and his general demeanour that they never actually got around to saying, excuse me, Mr. Sheridan, but you actually owe me money. So it was funny. That's one of the things about a hall.
One of the things that anecdote actually brings to mind is the differentiation that you talk about in your book between the public rooms, your ante rooms, your formal dining areas on the one hand, and then the family spaces, and how they were very distinctly separate. And I was wondering if you could speak a bit, because we've been talking up until now primarily about the public areas,
yeah.
If you could speak a bit more about the family spaces and how, what differentiated them and how they were different from each other.
There was always, when people go to the country house, there was always a sort of a, I think they call it a green baize door, behind which you would never go. So it would be indicated possibly by architecture, where you might have two opposite, we'd say, pilasters, and a door firmly closed, and you would assume that that would be the very private side of the house. So nobody attempted to go in there. So you'd have the public side and then the private side. Now, the private side could be fairly ordinary, because most people would spend a lot of money on the public side of the house because they wanted to show off what they had. So they'd have their pictures and they'd have all sorts of things, wonderful staircases, etc. But in the private rooms, the family spaces, they would have their bedrooms, bedrooms, dressing rooms, perhaps a closet or two. Usually the library, very often the library would also be a private room for the family. And it's, the library was an interesting space in that it evolved from very few people having books, because while men might read, certainly women didn't read at the very beginning of the 18th century, or not many women would have read at that point. But libraries became very important. And also it was a status symbol for the family to have one. But very often they could be situated in the private part of the house. So you would have, as I say, bedrooms, dressing rooms, and perhaps a closet or two. What I found interesting was, looking at architectural plans, you would have a Lady Coote's room. And then you'd look around and see, well, where was Lord Coote's room? And that wasn't to be seen. And then I went, you know, to different architectural plans to have a look and see, well, you know, where does he sleep? And it was only really when I looked at a later plan, which was dated to 1822, and it was a plan of Ballyfin in County Laois. A plan of Ballyfin, where I eventually discovered, and I actually had kind of discovered first of all by looking at men's dressing rooms, very often there was a smallish bed in it. And when I say small, like a single bed rather than a double bed, in men's dressing rooms or men's studies. And I had wondered about that. Is that where they sleep? So anyway, it became just ever so slightly clearer when we got to Ballyfin. And I saw on two, when I just compared the two floors, ground floor and the first floor, the bedroom floor, Lady Coote had a suite of a boudoir, a bedroom, and a dressing room. And then directly below her was Sir Charles Coote's writing room and his study, or I can't remember, was it called a study or something, own room, something like that it was called. And then I saw a tiny staircase which linked the two, one to the other. So I wasn't quite sure whether architects didn't like to sort of say, this is Sir Charles and Lady Coote's bedroom, or they never said, this is Sir Charles Coote's bedroom by itself without mentioning Lady Coote, because you'd probably assume that she was going to sleep there. But it appears that a lot of drinking went on in Irish houses, and so it became almost a habit that men sometimes, rather than disturb their wives upstairs, would sleep in their studies. And obviously for the begetting of children or anything like that, they would be sleeping together. But I think for the most part, they actually did sleep in the same room together. But maybe it was just being polite to the man who was building this house, and that the architect called it Lady Coote's room rather than Sir Charles. So that was really it. But it was kind of interesting trying to work that out. And then there were various examples of people writing to each other. Lord Townsend, who was Lord Lieutenant, that's the Queen's representative or the King's representative in Ireland at the time, he wrote to his wife saying how much he missed her in the bed. He was a guest in Castletown. He remembered the last time they were there together and she was in the bed with him. So I think it was really up to the couple themselves. And you also had to take into consideration that a lot of these couples would not be in love when they got married, and there were marriages of convenience and everything like that. So as long as they got the heir and the spare, they were happy enough to just leave it at that.
It was one of the things I found fascinating in your book is how you describe it wasn't just the sleeping spaces that were distinct and designated for in a lot of these plans for men and women, but also their dressing rooms, their you know, privies and so forth, that they had very different setups, and that they required separate rooms for those separate setups.
They did, and, you know, Mrs. Delaney, again, she gives us clues as to what happened there. A lot of women entertained in their dressing rooms. A lot of women entertained their women friends in their dressing room. So they would do things like they might all paint together, or somebody might read a story and they all listen to it. So it's sort of a girly place for them to be. Dressing rooms were sometimes very, very tiny spaces, quite interesting. Even in Rusborough, very, very small space. So sometimes ladies were asked to take off their hoops before going into the dressing room, so they would all fit. Yes, it was. They were private spaces, and they were private. It was known, society knew they were private spaces, and you simply did not go into a lady's dressing room or a lady's closet or her boudoir without being invited in. And that even went where, like, husbands would even say, may I come in, and that. So it was a very, very private space for a woman, where she had all of the things that she was particularly interested in, where she could meditate, she could read, she could write letters, she could escape from things. Like, there was I think it was Lady Louisa, or one of these women was writing to her brother and said, you know, oh, I've just escaped. I've got to my sanctum sanctorium, where I can now just write or do what I like just for a while to get away from everybody. It's so nice. But there, you know, I learned an awful lot about life in the 18th century from reading fiction of the time. And in one of those books, there was a young woman who was, this man kept on coming to her door and knocking, and she said, she made it perfectly clear, like, you don't do that sort of thing. You know, I, this is completely private. You know that it's my space, and I am not admitting you. And so all of that was really made perfectly, perfectly clear to people. But women also tried out colour schemes. And they, because the rooms were small, they could actually have them decorated quite cheaply. So they would buy fabrics to try out. They tried out architectural styles, colours and soft furnishings and that in them. And they just went around and admired them in each other's in each other's houses. And then, you know, a few months later, they could change the whole style again. So a lot of the advances in fabrics, in colours and all the rest of it, towards the end of the 18th century, colours which had been heavy, and fabrics which had been heavy damasks and silks, yes, but in dark colours, they got lighter and lighter as time went by. And also as influence of Chinese furniture and chinoiserie in general, with their lighter colours, came into vogue and arrived in places like England and in Ireland, that colours got brighter and fabrics got lighter as time went by. Also, men would have their studies or their dressing rooms, but they were totally different. And they would generally have, say, a painting of their house or of their domain. They would also have guns and all sorts of things like that. But it was very, very much a male space. And while, of course, people just didn't wander in and out, it hadn't got the same sort of magical feel that a woman's space had, particularly if a woman had a boudoir. That was another whole story.
Now, the restrictions on entering a woman's dressing room or boudoir, were those restrictions applied to the servants who would attend to those rooms as well? Did even they have to knock and request special permission to enter, or were they the exception? They were allowed to come and go because they were serving a particular role to maintain the room.
No, they couldn't. they could never just barge in at any time. They always had to ask for permission to go in. And I mean, they'd have to go in, obviously, and clean the place and do all of that. But no, if, you know, and I don't know, maybe the woman of the house sort of said, I am not to be disturbed. And if that's the case, that's it. But she might very well bring in her own personal maid. And interestingly, just on that particular subject, they didn't like having local people as their personal servants. Because, of course, anything that happened in the big house would be relayed to the entire local village. So they preferred landowners and owners of houses who were, of course, mostly Protestant, because the Catholics had lost all of their land. It had been taken from them by settlers and by soldiers in the wars and all the rest of it, who had become, you know, quite Irish at this stage. So they were mostly, the landowners would be mostly Protestant. And so they didn't want their personal servants to be anything but Protestant. And they certainly didn't want their children to be influenced by having their governesses or their maids Catholic. These would be people who would be dealing with the children, nursemaids and that. They had to be Protestant.
You mentioned near the end of the book about one lady writing about how she was bringing in somebody from England to serve as a servant, and about how she just felt that English Protestant serving girls were just cleaner than Irish Catholic girls.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the servants, first of all, with regard to servants, there were loads of servants in Irish houses. I mean, people used to talk about the numbers of servants, without end in Irish houses. And a lot of them would be simply hangers-on. You'd find them hanging around out in the gardens, and nobody would say anything. Or not out in the gardens, out in the working areas, like the farmyard and places like that. And they might be given little bits of pieces of jobs to do, and they might be handed a halfpenny or something tiny for that. And they would just be hangers-on, maybe relatives of people who were working in the house. But they'd loads and loads of servants. You couldn't afford to have livery for all of these servants. So very often they just didn't bother having livery at all. But for the liveried servants, I mean, they were the sort of upper class of servant. And it wasn't a bad job to be a servant in a house like that. But certainly the upper servants, they liked to get them from Scotland or they liked to get them from England, because they thought along the same lines as the owners of the houses did.
Fascinating. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, I was wondering if you could tell us what you're working on now.
Well, now, I thought I'd just have a lovely rest, but it doesn't work out like that. I'm very happy to say that the book has been getting very good reviews, and so I've been getting quite a number of speaking engagements. And I think I'm actually doing a speaking tour in the States in the new year, which is absolutely lovely. So that's one thing. I'm also doing some work on Dublin Castle, which is where the Lord's Lieutenant or Lieutenant lived, you know, up to the time we became independent. So I'm working on the presence chamber, which is the throne room. So I'm just trying to tease that out. It was burned during in the 20th century. It was burned by the middle of the 20th century. It was burned. And so there were various presence chambers in Dublin Castle. So I'm just sort of trying to work out, to do something on that. And the other thing that I'm working on, well, I haven't spent a lot of time, but I did, when I was waiting to hear from Yale, I spent quite a bit of time working on a project to do with wine, not drinking, not wine as a drink. Well, I love a drink of wine, but it's not that. It is actually the sort of material culture attached to it, the sort of glasses that were used, types of bottles, and all of the items that were used on a table and in a house that had anything to do with wine. I thought it could be of some interest.
It sounds like a fascinating project.
Could be. I hope so, anyway.
Well, thank you very much for being on the show today. I really enjoyed the opportunity to speak to you about Irish country houses in the 18th century. Have a good day.
Thank you very much indeed, Mark. Nice to talk to you. Bye-bye.